Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host, and very grateful you are here with us. Thanks for being here with us. As we promised, Open Forum continues this hour. Mark Brumley is our guest. Mark is president of Ignatius Press. Probably, I'm going to say, the most important publishing house in the entire Alpha Quadrant. Hello, Mark Brumley.
Hey, how are you doing, sir?
Really well. Oh, nice to see you. See, now I can see you.
Now you can see me. I
once
see you,
you start talking, your video comes on. I don't know why it works that way, but
all the people on the radio can't see us, but we can see each other, and
that's what
social
counts.
Media people can see us.
Yeah,
isn't that wonderful?
The number is 888-318-7884. There's three lines open. So if you've got a question about the Catholic faith, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're in agreement with the Catholic faith and just would like to understand better, or if there's something that you don't agree with and you'd like to hash it out with us, 888-318-7884. As the president of Ignatius Press, you must be awful proud. Constantly new stuff coming out that's good, high-quality stuff. What do you got now?
Yeah, and I want to mention some things. You and I have been having conversations. I think we did a Catholic Answers podcast on the topic of fiction, and we've had some conversations on this program about fiction. We actually have several novels coming out this fall, but we have two that have recently come out, and I want to mention them in connection with apologetics and a concept which I use, the term I use hesitantly with respect to these books, because I know author's sensitivity, and I want to be respectful of that.
I see.
The term I want to use is narrative apologetics. Are you familiar with that term?
I'm not. No, I don't think I know narrative apologetics.
Okay. Well, narrative apologetics is a term used to refer to an apologetical use of narrative, especially fiction. Okay. So fiction. So you use fiction as a way of defending the faith or responding to objections regarding the faith, showing the credibility of the faith, all the kinds of moves, as they say, that are involved with apologetics. Now, narrative apologetics is the kind of thing that we see, I think we see, in C.S. Lewis's famous space trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, Paralandra, and That Hideous Strength. It's the kind of thing that we see, just to some degree, even in terms of general credibility or plausibility of the Christian worldview in the broad sense, we see in Lord of the Rings, and a number of other works of fiction that have a sort of a certain kind of apologetical function. Now, why do I hesitate to use this out of due regard for authors? Well, they don't want their fiction to be understood as primarily about an apologetical argument. You're a fiction writer. You don't want people to think, oh, I'm just telling this story to, you know, try to win an argument or to make an argument. I'm telling this story because I love the story, I love the characters, I love the plot. And if it helps illuminate some aspect of reality, including the Christian aspects of reality, which ultimately God is the ultimate reality, so it's all about that. Well, that's great. That's wonderful. I'm not opposed to that. But, you know, that's not really why I'm writing. So that's a lot of fiction writers are sensitive to that. So this is all preface to say we've just come out with two books. I think I've mentioned these before, and they are very offbeat. They are fantasy bordering on horror. Catholic novelists. One is called This Thing of Darkness by K.V. Turley and Fiorella de Maria. I'm holding it up for the people who are on the radio and don't have the visual here. And this is a really macabre story about Hollywood, 1956, Bela Lugosi, and all kinds of supernatural things around Bela Lugosi and his background. And it's very eerie, and it's also very Catholic. So This Thing of Darkness, K.V. Turley, Fiorella de Maria. So people who like kind of scary, fiction-y, fantasy stuff, you're going to love this book. It's got endorsements by Joseph Pierce, Michael O'Brien, Sally Reed, various other people. So that's one book that we've come out with. Then another is a book called Providence Blue, A Fantasy Quest. And if you're a fan of H.P. Lovecraft, or Robert E. Howard, the creator of Conan the Barbarian, or Edgar Allan Poe. These are all characters that figure in this book. Again, I'm holding up the book for the people who can see this online, Providence Blue. And it's also, as I say, a kind of fantasy, bordering on horror, Catholic story. So it's there's Catholic elements to it and so on. Again, it's got great plugs by Ron Hansen. Many of the people out there will know Ron Hansen, the novelist Ron Hansen, Eleanor Nicholson, who wrote our book, A Bloody Habit, which was about a priest, you know, vampire hunter, and Father Weta, who wrote The Eighth Arrow, which is about Odysseus trying to escape from Dante's hell and so on. So these books, what do these books have in common other than being great works of fiction and exciting reads and all of that, and fantasy works? They give insight into the Catholic worldview, and they help readers see the credibility of the Catholic perspective.
I'm so glad you're publishing those books, because it just seems like there was a time when the Catholic author was a welcome part of the mainstream of authors, you know, the yes. Graham Greene time and Evelyn Waugh and all that.
But Flannery O'Connor.
It seems like the Catholic author is not welcome in the New Yorker circles anymore. You know, the person who's a serious Catholic. So you got to have a venue for those. Right. And when people discover them, they'll discover that I'm sure they'll discover very, very fine fiction that otherwise is just not. It doesn't have a place.
Right. And I would say about these books, because I read a lot of science fiction and fantasy stuff, among other things. I would say these are good books to read if you had no faith perspective. Mm-hmm. They're interesting stories, and they're not propaganda. That's why I want to underscore that point. When you talk about – so I use this expression, narrative apologetics. But again, they're not propaganda. They're just good books to read and interesting books to read with great stories and plots and exciting – characters and narratives and all of that, but they also have this other element or quality to them, in that they help see the credibility of the Christian worldview.
I love it. I feel like we Catholics, we lost our place in the culture that we had, I don't know, back in the before the John Kennedy days and leading up to that. And little by little, people are finding ways to recarve our place in the culture, you know? And I think that's great.
Yes, absolutely.
Want to do some calls?
Yeah, let's go to the calls.
All right, it's open forum, 888-318-7884, the number. James in Ohio watching on YouTube. You are first, and I know you've been very patient, James, from the last hour over, so thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
No problem. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so question I'd like to ask is about it's partly about God's character, but it's specifically about in the Levitical law, in Leviticus 18, where there's different death penalty sanctions by God giving it to the Israelites. And, of course, the one controversial one is with regards to homosexuality. Man shall not lie with a man, and so forth. Their blood shall be on their head, and they shall be put to death. I'm wondering, basically, I know some people have argued about whether or not that's the same thing of our understanding of homosexuality today, but irregardless of that, my main point question is, how is this consistent with God supposing to be all good and moral? It seems like a rather extreme reaction to something that you would find morally unethical. Like, why not just have a conversation with people if you're God, instead of just sentence them to death?
Okay. James, you know what? I'm going to let Mark answer that, just because we're getting on and we need to get an answer before the break. So you get the idea, though. Why would God do that?
We'll try to answer during the break. So this is a view that many people who approach Scripture in the Catholic tradition, how they would handle this question, and they would see that God, over a period of time, progressively reveals himself to people, that as a result of human sin and the conditions that came with that, human beings were our ideas about the world and about right and wrong and our ability to live well with one another, all these things were affected by sin, early sin, sin of the human race. And that includes our ability to understand God's will, God's love, and God's justice. And so God sort of treated humanity like little children, okay, and brought them along. And that included the kind of severity that sometimes children interpret when they are corrected or directed by their parents to do certain things and not do certain things. And so that's how I would see God's revelation in the Old Testament, not just regarding homosexuality. Even if you go back and you see how disobedient children are treated under the Mosaic Law, it's rather severe as well. And this is early revelation, how people of that day experienced and interpreted early revelation from God about moral rightness and moral wrongness. But as Christians, we don't look back to how God was revealed himself and was interpreted by Moses 3,000 years ago. We look to Jesus Christ, and he is our pattern for understanding the fullness, the full revelation of who God is, how God is just and loving. And so I look to the example. This is an example. It's not an example of homosexuality, but it is an example of the application of the death penalty to serious sin. You know, the woman caught in adultery. According to the Old Testament law, she was supposed to be stoned, put to death. And what did Jesus say when he encountered her? He who is without sin cast the first stone. In other words, you folks are not in a position to pass judgment on her as you think you are. He corrected her and he said, you know, don't do this anymore. But he also said that she was forgiven. Now, sometimes people use this passage in another conversation about the death penalty, where they're moving from the realm of morality to the realm of civil law, which I think is a dubious transition, but focusing on this question of the commandments of the death penalty and so on for homosexuality in the Old Testament, we say the same thing applies there with respect to homosexuality as applied to adultery. Jesus shows us how we should think about this. It's sinful. It's wrong to engage in same-sex sexual acts, just as it's sinful and wrong to engage in opposite-sex heterosexual acts with someone when you're married to someone else, or that person is married to someone else. These things are seriously wrong. They're contrary to God's purpose for us and contrary to our true fulfillment and happiness. But that doesn't mean we need to apply the death penalty. Now, I'm going to mention one other point that we need to bear in mind, and that is anytime we choose to put some created thing, some finite reality, whether it's another person or it's a thing or it's our own will, before the ultimate reality of God and the supreme being and the supremely good and the supremely true and the supremely beautiful and the supremely loving, anytime we do that, we set ourselves up in a relationship of opposition to our own true fulfillment and our own experience of ultimate goodness. In other words, we put ourselves in a position of death, not necessarily physical death, but spiritual death, because God is the source of life, and the opposite of life is death. And if we turn away from God, who is the source of our life, we put ourselves in a position of death. And that's what sin does. In the story of Adam and Eve in the garden, when they disobeyed God, what did they do? They experienced death, and not just the coming into the world of physical death for human beings, but the coming into the world of spiritual death, finding themselves at odds with God, who is the source of life. And what's the solution? Well, to turn from death to life. And who makes that possible? Jesus Christ makes that possible for us. And when we enter into a relationship with Christ by the transforming power of God and the grace of God, he turns our hearts away from these other things that are put in the place of God, to God, who is the source of our life. So I think that's the best way to think about whether you're talking about homosexuality and it being gravely sinful, or sex outside of marriage, it being gravely sinful, or adultery, it being gravely sinful. Those are all areas dealing with human sexuality. But we could talk about other areas, whether you're talking about sins of murder or sins of hatred. All these things turn us away from God, who is the source of life, and they turn us towards some form of spiritual death. And Jesus came for us to overcome that so that we don't have to experience that. So that's what I would say. I know that's a long answer to your question, but I try to put it into a overall kind of theological context.
And James, we'll have to let that stand. I hope that that was helpful. We got to take a quick break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The power of prayer simply means that words have an effect. For example, when a couple says, "I do," it literally changes two people to becoming one in marriage. When you say, "I love you," it changes us and it gives us value. The power of prayer is in the words and in the sentiment, but it's also in the fact that God, who is omnipotent, all-powerful, answers our prayers.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum. Mark Brumley is our guest, going back to the phones. But I am excited to tell you this, and I keep putting it off, and I haven't said it the whole program. We have a new free ebook this month for the month of September, a brand new free ebook, and it's from our good friend and former chaplain, Father Hugh Barber. And anything he writes, you're going to want to read it, but this one's really good. 5 Ways to Prepare for Communion. You can download it free at shop.catholic.com. 5 Ways to Prepare for Communion, from our own Father Hugh Barber at shop.catholic.com.
5 ways, huh?
Yeah, 5 ways to prepare for communion. One of them, get up, brush your hair.
Well, that's true. So before the next, go to the next call, I want to ask you a question about the last call.
Okay.
And I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay, put me on the spot.
So what did you think about that answer? So I was trying to put the question about homosexuality and capital punishment into a broader context. And sometimes that works for apologetics, and then sometimes it just falls flat.
Well, no, maybe it fell flat for the caller. I don't ever worry too much about that, because you win some, you lose some, as long as I was very happy when I heard you start talking about the woman caught in adultery, because that's the obvious New Testament place to go to get an insight into what God really teaches us about taking life for these moral infractions. So that I was very, very pleased. I didn't know I get to rate your answers now. So
you don't get to rate them in general, but okay. I just was kind of curious because, you do this all every day and you hear various apologists, myself included, give answers.
Yeah,
and I'm just curious.
Well, every day I see, sometimes I will see an answer where I think, as a matter of fact, Father Hugh had one this week where I think, you just couldn't answer that better than that. And the person utterly rejected the answer. And so you go, well, okay, but that was a great answer if you're ready to hear it. So
that's one of the deadly sins of apologetics is to assume that, will grant me that I gave a cogent, solid argument there. Okay.
Yeah.
But one of the deadly sins is to presume that anytime you give a cogent, solid argument that you're going to persuade.
No,
and
that's
of course,
right.
It doesn't follow at all.
No. As a matter of fact, sometimes you can give I've heard people just give an answer where you go, oh, it just makes me as a believing Christian feel so inspired. Nothing for the person who gets the answer. Zero. There are, by the way, 7 deadly sins of apologetics. I think that you know this, Mark, because you're the author of a book called 7 Deadly Sins of Apologetics.
So, my mistakes and how you can learn from them. That's what the subtitle should be. There's a different subtitle.
My mistakes.
My mistakes and how you can learn from them.
Yeah, you can get that too at shop.catholic.com.
Well, I just mentioned, I wanted to ask you that question because there's kind of a move in apologetics now, at least I'm observing it, to be much more, and I mentioned this earlier in the context of fiction, you know, narrative apologetics, with respect to writing, you know, fiction as a kind of undergirding an apologetical vision, but more generally a sort of a testimonial approach to apologetics where you're trying to help people enter into the story of God's reality as the church presents it, and that requires more of a conversation and
yes, I think that's generally
something more. Anyway, I just mentioned that. Kind of curious.
Yeah,
I didn't mean to hold up the show here.
No, you didn't hold up the show. Opportunities for me to talk are very rare on this program, and I value them.
All right,
Elizabeth in Oklahoma City, you're next. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Hi, I have a friend who is not Catholic, but he believes in the transubstantiation. However, he believes that he can just pray over his Protestant Eucharist and it becomes the body and blood of Christ. And I'm not sure how to adequately explain how transubstantiation happens because of apostolic succession.
I see. Okay. So when you say he can pray over his elements of communion in his church, you mean he's a pastor, or is he just a, you know, a member of the congregation?
Just a member of the congregation.
Okay, so the pastor or the ministers in the church, they distribute the elements of communion, and he prays over them, and he thinks his praying over them will turn them into the body and blood of Christ.
Yes, he's been to Mass many times, and I don't know what he prays, but I'm assuming he probably prays the same prayers that he hears the priest pray.
Maybe.
Right. Okay. Well, what I would say to this is, you know, certainly in the Scripture, Jesus is speaking to the apostles. He tells them to do this in his memory. And we know from history that priests, presbyters, elders were the people who presided over the Eucharistic celebration. And so, my question for him would be, where does he, and I would try to not phrase this unduly in an unduly provocative way, but where does he think he, as a, just an individual Christian, gets the authority, the apostolic authority, to act in with the authority of Jesus Christ when it comes to the Eucharist? Where does he get that from? It's wonderful that he has the insight that communion is something more than a mere symbol, and that it is the reality of communion for the Christian is that it's the body and blood of Christ. It's a participation in the body and blood of Christ. But I would challenge him on the basis upon which he thinks that he, just as an individual, has the power to make Christ's present body, blood, soul, and divinity, when certainly, if we go back to the earliest Christian records of this, it's clearly it's the bishop and the presbyter, that is to say, the divinely ordained leader of that community, the community of believers, who exercises this function, I should say, through whom Christ himself exercises this function. So that's what I would ask him. And I think that's a good way to proceed.
Does that work, Elizabeth?
Yes, thank you.
All right. And who's the little one with you?
My son.
Oh, I for a second I thought, you know what I thought it was? I thought it was the tornado warning. Because I know you have that in Oklahoma. I was like, no, that's a baby.
Thank you so much.
Oh, okay. All right. Go ahead.
I hear the sound of the music.
And that means we've got to take a quick break. Thanks, Elizabeth. More on the line. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Our guest is Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press, the most important publisher in the Alpha Quadrant. We'll be right back with more of your questions. And there's two lines open, 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Music on this Thursday afternoon. Maybe it's Friday morning where you are. We already got one call from Friday morning, but it's maybe Thursday evening where you, wherever you are. We're just happy you're here and happy to share the groovy music. And Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, and me, your host, Cy Kellett. I have to say it slow sometimes because people think my name is Psych. They go, "Who is Psych Ellett?"
And I Psych Ellett.
Yeah.
So what name was he?
My name is like, yeah, it's not me, but that's what my name sounds like when I say it fast. 888-318-7884, the number, and it's not a really good day until you get a call from Nebraska. Michelle in York, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. You are up next. Michelle, go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Great. Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
My question is, I was at our Catholic bookstore lately, and there were different versions of the Catechism of the Catholic Faith. I have one, I think that is the title, it's just Catechism of the Catholic Faith. And then I saw some that were like Baltimore Catechism, and so I was just wondering why there are different versions and which one we're supposed to be using.
What kind of a crazy Catholic bookstore is there? Mark, why do we have all these catechisms?
Okay, so there are major catechisms and there are minor catechisms or secondary catechisms. The major catechisms, there's actually been two. There's what's called the Roman Catechism or so-called Catechism of the Council of Trent, and there's the Catechism of the Catholic Church, a copy which I'm holding up right now. And major catechisms are, as I said, there's only been two, and they are summary documents. So the Catechism of the Catholic the Council of Trent, the so-called Roman Catechism. That was after the Council of Trent in the 16th century, and over a period of time, it's not that the faith changes, but certain things get clarified and teachings get presented in different ways, and things that were presented as true but not necessarily as dogma get clarified as dogma. And so there's a need to update, to restate, to present different ways over time, and the various church documents get issued and so on. So the Catechism of the Council of Trent, a Roman catechism, got replaced, if you will, or updated by the what we call now the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which came out in the early 90s and following the Second Vatican Council. So it's so that's a major catechism, and it's really the standard reference point now if you want to know what the Catholic Church teaches. There are, as I say, lesser catechisms or minor catechisms, and these are books that are written based upon the catechism, the major catechism, to try to explain the faith to different groups. So you might, so we have, for example, at Ignatius Press, we publish a thing called UCAT, which is short for Youth Catechism, and it's based upon the major catechism, the Catholic of the Catholic Church, but it's written in a way that's more accessible for young people. There are other catechisms published by different groups and different people. Sometimes they're private catechisms, sometimes they're official catechisms. For example, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops published a catechism for the United States of America that's based upon the Catechism of the Catholic Church, for the whole church, catechism, U.S. catechism for adults, you know, incorporates things like little vignettes from American saints and restates things in ways that the drafters of the catechism think will be more accessible to adults living in the United States and that sort of thing. So there are lots of different reasons why the teaching of the catechism, the major catechism, gets restated in other kinds of catechetical writings or things called catechisms. Sometimes it's to reach out to a particular age group, like young people. Sometimes it's to reach out to a particular national group, like Americans. It can be to feature certain aspects of the faith, emphasize certain dimensions of the faith. So, for example, there's a book out there called The Business Catechism, where the teaching of the church that pertains to business is summarized and expressed. So, and there are official catechisms that come from the church in some official capacity, and there are other catechisms. We have, for example, a book called Catholic Christianity by Peter Kraft. Peter Kraft is a popular Catholic writer, and he takes the teaching of the Catechism of the Catholic Church and he presents it in his own way. It's a unofficial catechism. It's consistent with the Catechism of the Catholic Church, but it's not issued by an official expression of the magisterium of the church. So those are some of the reasons why you're going to have different versions of things called catechisms published under the auspices of Catholics. Does that help, Michelle?
Yes, that is very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very, very much. While you were at that Catholic bookstore, did you happen to see a book called A Teacher of Strange Things or another book called Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics? Did they have either of those?
Yes, actually they did.
That's a good
aside. When I started my kind of faith journey, Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics was one of the first ones I bought.
And
one of the last books I just bought was Teacher of Strange Things. So there you go.
You're the best. Michelle, you are the best. Wait, we have a new book coming out, and I'm going to give it to you before you can buy it, because you are so good. I want to give you Steve Weidenkopf's book, Light from Darkness. Nine times the Catholic Church was in turmoil and came out stronger than before. That's the newest book from Catholic Answers Press, so you get it before anybody else. Okay, Michelle?
Oh, my gosh, I'd love that.
All right, Thomas, will you send her that book, Light from Darkness? All right, we're going to put you on hold. Michelle, she's all right.
Well, yeah,
she bought our books, your book and my book. She bought them.
Yeah, isn't it great? And it's funny because you mentioned Teacher of Strange Things. I'm just looking at the summer sale catalog from Ignatius Press, and what do I see?
Is it in there?
A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy Kellett.
Wow.
There it is.
Man, yeah, I'm having a great day. Michelle made me happy. We got to go. Let's go to New Mexico now. Michael in New Mexico, listening to EWTN on Sirius XM satellite radio channel 130. Michael, thank you so much for your call. Oh no, Mike! As soon as I said it, Michael dropped. Come on, I got to do better than that. It wasn't me. I didn't push the wrong button. Ben in San Antonio, Texas, listening on 89.7 FM. Ben, we're glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Good afternoon, Mark. I was calling because I was interested in the discussion on fantasy and literature and outreach. I often hear fantasy elements used as a tool for evangelization, but I also hear a lot of rallying against fantasy elements in literature, especially mainstream things like Harry Potter or maybe Dungeons and Dragons. Do you have any additional clarification or follow-up on why those particular fantasy things tend to be rallied against as opposed to other portrayals of fantasy elements?
Those two in particular, Harry Potter and Dungeons and Dragons?
Yes.
Okay. Mark, do you have a view on why those are controversial?
So Dungeons and Dragons is a role-playing game, right? And Harry Potter is a book, or a series of books, just to make that distinction. Opinions vary among faithful, committed Catholics about things like Harry Potter, and even among Ignatius Press authors, and I'm sure there's a similar thing at Catholic Answers, there are opinions that differ on this. So with respect to Harry Potter, we have Michael O'Brien, who is himself an outstanding Catholic novelist and has elements of fantasy in some of his stories. He's a very strong critic of Harry Potter, and I think it's because in his view, Harry Potter, because it positively depicts the use of witchcraft, wizardry, he thinks that it's apt to seduce people or confuse young people so that they think things like wizardry and witchcraft are real and good, and he will make the point that they're not real in the sense that they are not what they seem to be, and that they are bad because they are associated with diabolical sources, diabolical origins. So, and I think Michael would represent that take on things. There are other Catholic writers who have a different view of Harry Potter. They see this as fictional magic, that it's not intended to be taken seriously. It's not depicted as a serious thing, and it's not seen as having its origin in the occult and so on. I think probably even people that are more favorable to Harry Potter would say, well, you still have to be cautious. Anytime you're dealing with fantasy fiction and fantasy materials or even science fiction, there's a certain caution you have to have, because especially with young people, because young people oftentimes are not adequately equipped to distinguish what's real from what's pretend. And so when you're dealing with fantastical things, whether it's fantasy fiction or science fiction, sometimes young people can be misled and get caught up in things that are harmful to them because they don't always adequately distinguish fact from fantasy. So on the Harry Potter thing, I see elements of both sides. I myself have read all the Harry Potter books. I would not discourage sufficiently mature young people from reading them, because I think there's a lot of good things in them. But I also understand why other people feel that they're too dangerous or they're problematic, and therefore they don't recommend them. So I can see both sides of that. I think the same thing, by the way, this would be a point where Michael and I would disagree. Michael O'Brien and I would disagree. When I was in high school and I was an evangelical Christian, before I became a Catholic, I was very suspicious of Tolkien and Lord of the Rings. Why? Well, because Gandalf is a wizard. And he obviously uses wizardry and uses supernatural powers to do various things. And there are all kinds of things that I regarded as occultic things in The Lord of the Rings. And besides, all the people I knew who liked Lord of the Rings or who liked The Hobbit when I was in high school were into drugs, you know? So I just associated this with drug culture and hippies and all kinds of stuff. Now that
Led Zeppelin
dates me, shows you how far back I go. And then, you know, as an evangelical Christian, I was very suspicious of that. And I found out that Tolkien, of course, well, that when I discovered he was a Catholic, I was like, well, that figures. He would be in the occult, right? Did I mention I was an anti-Catholic evangelical at this point? Anyway,
you didn't say anti-Catholic, but yeah, we got
the
idea.
But I was pretty anti-Catholic. But, you know, C.S. Lewis won me over. Chronicles of Narnia won me over. And then I found out that Tolkien was a friend of Lewis's, and I kind of softened in my Catholicism. And I actually read The Hobbit, and I read Lord of the Rings, and it clicked. I saw, no, he's not promoting the occult, and Gandalf is a wizard, but, you know, and he's a kind of supernatural being. He's kind of an angelic, low-level angelic sort of being, and it's not intended to be, you know, perfectly consistent with all aspects of Christian revelation and so on. And it was just a fun story of good versus evil. As I said earlier, when I talk about narrative apologetics, it created a fictional space where I think some people can be more open to the Christian perspective. And I, as an evangelical Christian at that point, found it something that opened me up to a more sacramental view of Christianity and therefore more of an openness to Catholicism. So that's an example. Do I think Lord of the Rings is occult and diabolical because it's got a wizard in it? No. Do I think there are people that misread it, misuse it, and have gotten into bad things as a result of it? Yeah, because I knew people in high school who did that. So we have to be cautious about these things. By the way, the same can be said of non-fantasy fiction as well.
There
are people who read novels that have elements in them that lead to all kinds of wrong ideas and immorality. And so people need to exercise good judgment about what they read, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, and when it's fiction, whether it's fantasy or other kinds of fiction.
Thanks, Ben. We got to go take a quick break, so we will do that. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Isn't it awesome that we today do not recognize His presence in the Eucharist? Is it because we really don't go to Him in humbleness of heart and say, Lord, I don't believe, help my unbelief. Lord, I want to see You. I want to recognize You. I cannot live without You. Are we saying that?
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Mark Brumley is our guest, and up next is Margaret in Iowa, listening on 94.5 FM. Margaret, you there with us? Maybe not. I really thought Margaret was going to say...
What are you, dumping callers today?
No, I'm not. I think I'm making them wait for a long time, but I heard Margaret's dog...
I'm making them wait, but...
Margaret, she's making herself a cup of coffee. She's like,
yeah, I'm here.
Oh, Margaret, you're there with us. How are you?
Yes, I'm here. I'm fine, thank you.
Great. It's great to talk with you. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Yeah, my question is about St. Joseph. While in Africa, I was working for ecumenism with the Muslims, And one of the imams gave me the Quran, and in some verses of the Quran, it talks about Joseph, not as husband of Mary, but that he took care of Mary, that he had his own family and took care of Mary when Mary was expecting Jesus, and he never married her. But as Catholics, we believe that Joseph is the spouse of Mary, and yeah, that has been kind of...
So do you want to know what the Catholic Church believes about whether or not Joseph was married to Mary?
Yeah, I know that we believe that Joseph is the husband of Mary, but just getting to, you know, getting the clarity between the Muslim belief and the Catholic belief.
Yeah, so how might you respond to a Muslim, Mark, who said Joseph wasn't married to Mary?
Right, so there's a broader conversation about where we go for our information about Mary and Joseph and Jesus and God. And the Muslim is going to go to the Quran, and a Christian is going to go to the Bible, which includes the New Testament and the Gospels and so on. And so we would have to have a conversation about whether we have good reason for thinking the Quran tells us something more reliable about Joseph and Mary and Jesus than what the Gospels tell us. And I'm going to say we don't have any good reason. In fact, we have reason to think that the Quran is not a reliable source of information. For no other reason, the fact that the Quran came into existence, you know, in the 7th century. I know that a Muslim will claim that it's, you know, divinely revealed and so on, but, you know, that's not a claim that I'm just going to take at face value, because I can claim, as Christians do claim, that the New Testament is divinely inspired. Okay, so we look at which sources, you know, Matthew and Luke and John, those are the three Gospels that refer to, well, actually, all four Gospels in some way or another bring in Mary and Joseph, but talk about the relationship of Mary and Joseph, especially the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke. These things were written within a single human lifetime, okay? So they're not coming many, many centuries after the time they purport to depict. The Gospels were written within 30, 40, 50 years, maybe 60 at most, of the time of the events that they're written as that they represent and depict. What's more, we have a fairly good understanding of how the traditions about Jesus and his parents got transferred and conveyed to the wider church. We have very little idea about the source, humanly speaking, of these traditions that are in the Quran. The only thing we have is a claim by the followers of Muhammad that these are of divine origin, and there's no claim to historical reliability and so on. If you open up the Gospel of Luke, you'll see right out of the bat, Luke claims to have investigated the matters that he is writing about. We don't have anything like that in the Quran. So just looking at it from simply from a perspective of historical evidence, there's much more credibility that the Gospels have regarding Jesus and his family relations than what the Quran has. Now, I'm not here to trash talk Muslims. I'm just simply saying that when we compare these things, we see that there's historical credibility for what the Gospels say about Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, and there's no historical basis for what the Quran says, and the Quran comes 600, 700 years after the time of Jesus and the events that the Gospel writers depict with respect to Jesus, Mary, and Joseph.
Okay, Margaret?
Okay, yeah.
Makes sense?
It's like the difference between, you know, somebody living in the 13th century you know, the 1200s, writing about something that happened in the 1200s, having access to people who lived at that time, getting their testimony and their accounts of what happened in the 1200s, and someone today coming out of the blue saying, I've got a revelation from God. This is what happened in the 1200s.
Yeah, that's exactly really, what it's like.
You know, a comparison. So I hope that's helpful, Margaret.
Margaret, you said you had these conversations with Muslims in Africa. Where are you from in Africa?
I'm originally from Kenya, and where I was studying Justice and Peace in Catholic University of Eastern Africa, and was working with ecumenism.
Oh, well, wonderful. Now you live in Iowa.
Yes, I live in Iowa.
Very cool.
Wonderful.
Very cool.
That's great.
I feel like the weather might be better in Kenya. I don't know, though. I'm not sure. Less snow.
Yeah, but of course, James Kirk is not going to be from Kenya. Other great people in the Federation will be from
James Kirk is from Iowa?
Yeah.
I didn't even know that. Margaret, do you even know who James Kirk is? Do you have any idea what we're talking about?
No.
Because it's an American television show from the 1960s. All right. It was very pleasant
Margaret,
to talk with
thank
you.
Thank you for your patience with me. I appreciate it.
I know. Really? Mark. All right. Let's see if... let's go to Harry in Salem, Massachusetts, the very heart of world culture.
Harry from Salem, Massachusetts.
Yeah, Harry from Salem, Massachusetts.
Hi, Harry.
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Very good.
Fine.
I have a question about lukewarmness. I'm trying to make sure that I'm on the right track with my lifestyle. I go to confession and mass every Sunday, and I quit smoking pot and cigarettes, and I basically don't even drink anymore. I just probably have a few drinks if I go to a wedding or something, but I don't get drunk or anything, and I don't swear anything. I'm trying to read the Bible in a year program. I don't read it, but it's being read to me by Father Michael Schmitz.
Oh, wow.
So I'm involved in that just so I can say I completed that.
But
so
you're worried that you're lukewarm.
Day. Yeah, I don't want to be lukewarm. I just want to make sure I'm on the right track, you know.
Boy, listening to you, Harry, makes me want to different. Harry?
No, I'm praying like crazy, you know?
You're praying like crazy. Well, that doesn't sound lukewarm, but Mark?
Harry, you make me worried that I'm lukewarm. I hear all the stuff that you're doing.
I don't know, but I was praying four rosaries a day, and plus I'm praying about 12 to 15 saints a day, and the Blessed Virgin Mary, you know,
Holy
Sacred Heart of Jesus, Sacred Heart of Mary. I'm praying all these a day. Now, you know what it is? Once I started doing the rosary every day, my prayer life started picking up, doing more and more and more every day, and I keep adding more things to it.
And it's you're like praying incredible. For people? Are you praying for other people?
Yeah. Oh, yes, I am. I pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy every day. Every day. I used to do four rosaries a day. I got too much, so I cut back to just one rosary a day. I do the Chaplet of Divine Mercy every day. I pray for the world. I'm praying for the president. I'm praying for the country. I'm praying for my family every day.
Holy smokes,
well,
Harry.
Harry, that sounds great. Yeah. So, I mean, do you love God?
Oh, I love God. Yes, so absolutely.
Do you want to love him more?
Yeah.
Do you want to spend eternity with him?
Absolutely. That's
do you want to avoid? Do you want to avoid things that displease God?
Yes, I do, and I've been doing that.
Then I don't think you need to worry about lukewarmness. I think you should thank God.
What are some of the things you think people who need to worry about lukewarmness do that they could be in trouble?
Well, they're not doing four rosaries a day and say going to confession every Sunday.
Right.
I mean, every Saturday.
I'd say that people who don't pray, there's a risk of real serious risk of lukewarmness. They don't go to mass. They don't go to confession. They're not taken seriously following Jesus.
And also, you're just inspiring to hear. You can hear it in
Absolutely.
Your voice. I feel inspired by you, Harry. And so I'm super grateful for your call. Thomas, let's give Harry any Catholic Answers book he wants. Any Catholic Answers book he wants. Because that's how I feel about Harry. Thomas is rolling his eyes because that's work for him at the end of the show. Thomas, you're lukewarm. Stop being lukewarm.
Don't be lukewarm, Thomas.
Mark Brumley, it's always such a pleasure. President of Ignatius Press, the author of Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
All right.
God bless you.
We'll see you next time. And we'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.